I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for poems that interest us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I've taken Poem Talk on the road to Chicago, where we're gathered at the Regenstein Library of the University of Chicago, and where I'm joined by Judith Goldman, whose research interests are wide-ranging and include, among them currently, the relation of violence to representation in contemporary experimental poetry, author of two books of verse, Vocoder, Roof, 2001, did I pronounce that correctly? Vocoder and Death Star Ricochet, published by O, 2006, and co-editor with Leslie Scalapino of War and Peace, an annual anthology of experimental writing against the war, and whose effect as a poet has been described as that of a situationist armed with a search engine. And by David Pavlich, editor and publisher of Answer Tag Limited Editions Chapbooks, author of, among other works, two poems, that's the title, in collaboration with Jesse Seldes, published in 2006, and who is our host here today in his capacity as bibliographer for modern and contemporary poetry at the Regenstein's fabulous Special Collections Library and Archive that includes, among its many treasures, the Papers of Poetry magazine. And by, speaking of Poetry Magazine, Don Scher, senior editor at Poetry here in Chicago, formerly curator of the great Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard, once poetry editor of Partisan Review, I didn't know that, Don, before I checked that out, and author of books of poems, including in 2007, published by Salt, Squandermania, a title that forms the basis, too, of his wonderful blog, Squandermania and Other Foibles, subtitled No Ideas, But in Blogs, How True It Is. Hello, all three of you. Thank you, David, for hosting us here at your home base.
Happy to have you. Welcome to Chicago.
And thanks, all three of you, for welcoming me to your fabulous, windy, and today, cool city. Hello, Judith and Don.
Hello.
Hi.
So we veered from Philadelphia and might as well veer a bit from the usual Poem Talk structure. Today, we'll consider two poems which have a close relationship. One is H.D.'s 1916 poem, Sea Poppies, and the other is Jennifer Scapitone's Vase Poppies, or Vase Poppies, we'll talk about that, in 2002. The later poet took the earlier poem and wrote through it, substituting words but always keeping to parts of speech, almost always, and to some extent keeping to the original sound. We don't, alas, have a recording of H.D. reading this poem, although Penn Sound does make available some fabulous HD audio. We do have Jennifer Scapitone reading her poem as part of her 2004 Segway series reading at the Bowery Poetry Club. So I've asked Judith to read HD's Sea Poppies first, and then we'll hear Jen herself reading Vase Poppies. So here's Judith.
Sea Poppies. Amber husk, fluted with gold, fruit on the sand, marked with a rich grain. Treasure, spilled near the shrub pines to bleach on the boulders. Your stalk has caught root among wet pebbles and drift flung by the sea and grated shells and split conch shells. Beautiful, widespread, fire upon leaf, what meadow yields so fragrant a leaf as your bright leaf?
This little poem was written through H.D.'s poem, Sea Poppies. Vase poppies, lavenderish dusk strapped for stays, pomegranates under the rubber band chucked for a glass oz, let down splayed by the pillar shelves to page upon the ottoman. His talk has wrought suit amid citrus gapes and pall dunked in the bowl and grated sage or cleaved clear paleo pines. Postgeist, upcast, California upon weed, what banker yields so fragrant a cant as this vagrant cant?
David, why would anyone write through someone else's poem? Let's talk about that first. Do you mind?
Well, there, you know, there could be a lot of reasons why somebody would write through somebody else's poems. I mean, some people might write through a poem as a kind of critique of that poem. Some people might write through a poem as a kind of homage to that poem. And I think that this one, it probably is a little bit of both, or maybe a lot of both. I think that, you know, the poem could be read as much a critique as of H.D.'s poem as it could be read an homage to H.D.
Judith, to the extent that it's a critique, what would it be critiquing?
I think that the poem is sort of messing around with the containedness of H.D.'s lines, the spareness. I think it's trying to open that up and add words, for instance, with many more syllables in general than the original poem had. I think also that the poem is interested in playing with the original poem's cadences and its patterns, its sonic patterns.
Can you give us an example of playing with cadences?
Destroying those as well. For instance, amber husk, lavenderish dusk. Right, so we have a rhyme there, but it's sort of avoiding the insistent trochees in H.D.'s lines with the lavenderish. It still has the accent on the first syllable, but we have this sort of very cumbersome four-syllable word.
Lavenderish, well, so she's got amber and lavender, so we're in the color palette. Uh-huh. But lavender and lavenderish tonally sounds like undoing, critique, maybe even mock. The tone is so different. What do you think, Don?
Well, those words are so old-fashioned themselves that it makes H.D.'s poem sound more contemporary by comparison. amber is a word, you know, as an editor we see in, you know, like every seventh poem somebody has, you know, things like amber. It's sort of almost
so lavender
a zeitgeist
is Victorian.
Word.
Is lavender Victorian?
Well, it has that feel to it. And we think of H.D. as being old-fashioned.
Well, we think of H.D.
Here we flipped
it. I mean,
it.
Those of us who, you know, teach the great break of imagism, H.D. and her contemporaries are sticking it to the
mm-hmm.
Victorians,
right.
Saying, among other things, you guys talk too much, your lines are too long, let's get down to the basics. And here, Jennifer, I think you're saying, is maybe pointing out that that might be the reverse?
I think so. It's interesting. If you saw Sea Poppies today without any attribution, you would think that it is doing a very contemporary thing in critiquing the language, so that a hallmark of H.D.'s poem is the two times when she dismantles rhyme so that the grated shells and conch shells are different shells. They're not the same things at all. They're sort of, you know, they're not rhymes. They're fake rhymes, faux rhymes, like a contemporary poet would do. Same thing with so fragrant a leaf as your bright leaf. Those are different concepts. The first leaf is kind of a generic thing that you visualize, but your bright leaf is very specific. And those are things that we think to do today, I mean, probably because someone like H.D. has done them. But the newer poem short-circuits that entire, or goes around that entirely. There's nothing like that in the more recent poem.
His talk has wrought suit amid citrus gapes and pall dunked in the bowl and grated sage or cleaved clear paleo pines.
David, paleo pines is very different from conch shells. Conch shells is so HD-ish. Paleo pines almost suggests a prior, even earlier, nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that paleo pines, you know, I think those who have read H.D.'s work know the poem Oread pretty well, which has
pine
trees. Is
that the whirl up sea?
Yeah, actually,
one?
Let me, you know, it's five lines, so I can actually just read it. So Oread, whirl up sea, whirl your pointed pines, splash your great pines on our rocks. Hurl your green over us, cover us with your pools of fur. So when I, you know, when I came across that that word paleo pines, I mean, it seems like a yet another allusion to another H.D. poem. But this is also, you know, one of the moments in Jen Scapitone's poem where it takes the scene, as it were, back outdoors. I mean, you know, H.D.'s poem is the context is really nature. It's the sort of out of doors. It's the sea and the land. You know, but Jen Scapitone has taken the poem indoors into a kind of Victorian setting, like
yeah, with a vase or a vase. Mm-hmm.
She's taking it indoors to show that it was precious in the first place, or she's taking it indoors just to undo the nature stuff. I'm not quite following.
I think actually,
just being a moderator.
It's a writing through of HD's poem, but it is also a commentary on yes. HD's own project.
So what was that?
And
commentary?
So in the first verse, I take lavenderish dusk strapped first days, pomegranates under the rubber band. Those three lines, those are about Victorianism, right? The stays, yeah. And I love the strapped for stays in the sense of you're strapped for cash, right? Strapped for stays strap you. The idea of pomegranates under the rubber band, like that, I mean, that's another way of phrasing a brassiere, for instance. I mean,
mm-hmm. So why would Jan Scabatone deliberately decorate or over-elaborate a famously precise natural description poem? Why would she do that? What point is she making?
I think that what she's saying is that that kind of thing is chucked for a glass Oz, and that sea poppies is the glass Oz. And so we can kind of go from there that, you know, is that so different from the Victorian mm-hmm. scene or not, right? And therein is
I also have a reading of it that uh-huh. I have the idea she and lots of other people would hate. And that is that, I mean, you know, Jen is domesticating this.
Yes,
literally. Absolutely. So you have household things. I mean, you've cut, you know, the sea poppy, the poppies aren't alive anymore. They're stuck in for decoration. It's something that she, as a woman living in a house or apartment, would actually see in her life. I mean, this is something, it's taken from her bodily existence. It's sort of putting a real body back into the poem, because there's always something a little disembodied in HD. I mean, that's the general critique of her work, you know, today. It's sort of, you know, that she was cerebral or emotional, but that the body has to be put back in. And I think that Jen has very sort of honestly, in other words, not as a critique, read this poem as a woman, you know, living in a particular place, and not doing it as some kind of, you know, descriptive narrative or confessional thing, or this is my life or something, but that it's true to her own existence.
Judith
and domesticating
David,
it isn't a bad thing.
What do you think of Don's reading?
Well, my reading is a little bit different, and that is that, you know, by bringing the poem indoors, what I was seeing Jen Scapitone doing here is that she's suggesting that HD's world was actually much more about kind of this contained Victorian culture than HD may be letting on. And so, you know, when you read Jen Scapitone's poems, all of these sort of inside or domestic nouns or adjectives or what have you, they're all a little bit out of date. They're all a little bit wealthy or bourgeois sounding. I mean, you have lavender, you have pomegranates, glass, pillar shelves, which seems to indicate enormous mm-hmm. library shelves, the ottoman.
Sounds like stuff that comes out of catalogs or, you know, perfumed like in the body shop
could.
Or something.
Grated sage.
Yeah. Grated sage. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lavenderish dusk strapped for stays, pomegranates under the rubber band chucked for a glass Oz, let down splayed by the pillar shelves to page upon the ottoman.
Here's my problem with HD. I love the poetry, and every time I read it, I can't help but think that there's another reading which is entirely programmatic, self-conscious, and polemical. Not so much the sea poppies, but Oread or Sea Rose, where she's saying, damn it, she's using command verbs all the time. We have to write about this. This is the kind of rose we want, not some big Andrew Carnegie. He has a metaphor about the American Beauty rose. You know, we need to cut all the stinted roses and just produce one. You know, no, we want the sea rose. We want the thorny roses. So that her, and even here, there's a lot of polemic at the end. She's addressing herself to the poppy and saying, what meadow yields so fragrant a leaf as your bright leaf? She's not really asking an open-ended
right.
question. She's saying, look, I know exactly where to find this, and this is what poetry ought to be from now on. So I always read these poems as doubling. I think Jennifer Scapitone is seeing the doubling, and especially at the end when she refers to Kant, as in a sort of ready ideological talk or programmatic talk, it seems to me that Jen is responding to the programmatic quality, which is somewhat unconscious in HD. So I think that the critique is against the programmatic quality of it for being under the surface. What do you think?
Well, isn't – I mean, my interpretation of imagism in general is that, you know, I think I've always thought that there has been a misunderstanding that imagism is mostly about nature and the image, which it is, but it also, you know, is defined as creating an intellectual and emotional complex in an instant of time, and intellectual is in that, you know, it's in that equation. I think that imagist
intellectual,
poems have,
aesthetic, ideological, programmatic.
Right,
this
and
is,
so programmatic,
this is the new poetry.
I don't know that HD would necessarily, that it's unconscious. I mean, I think that it's fully conscious. I think HD knew exactly what she was doing.
Okay, I'll amend what I said.
Right.
She knew that she knew what she was doing, but she also could get away with, huzzah, finally we're back to basics.
If you read it with a particular approach, then it's a lovely nature poem. If you read it with another, then it is a polemic that, you know, well, that is probably
in my opinion,
necessary.
This is why team. This was so crucial, not just HD, but imagism generally, for Harriet Monroe at Poetry Magazine, where she was able to say, we've got a programmatic thing, we're breaking ground. So she could appeal to London and New York. She could also appeal to the blue-haired ladies in St. Louis, forgive me, who supported her, and Chicago, by saying, look, poetry is back to the image, it's back to something beautiful, it's not simply sentiment. All you need is what you have in front of you. So it plays a double game, not just for the poet, but for the institution that supported it. Judith, you're nodding.
I think that that is part of the beauty and economy of HD's poem, is that it's double, it's Janus facedness, right? In the sense that it can be a nature poem, and at the same time, it can be an agenda-based ideological poem that's quite self-reflexive, and where the poppy is, you know, a stand-in for the poem and what poetry should be. But you can read it both ways. And I also think that in terms of her talking about the sea, the idea that your stalk has caught root among wet pebbles and drip flung by the sea, we have the idea of not just a maternal matrix, but something that's really rhizomatic, as opposed, you know, and sort of networky, this network of roots and loose soil or loose pebbles, as opposed to the conch shell type of sort of whole, present, sound, you know, that kind of
with
more
echoes.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's one reading.
David,
I had
what do
it.
You think about the very end then? So fragrant.
Well, what,
a can.
I guess
is
what
it,
jumped
is it
out
unironic?
At me,
fragrant,
you know,
is unironic?
Fragrant is unironic.
Meaning it really is fragrant. Yeah,
it's hard to believe that it would be used.
It's the same word as in the original. It's the only
non-ironically or unironically. But I guess when I first hit this stanza, what jumps out is California.
I was going to say, we left, you know, out, and California upon weed,
well,
and if you're smoking
exactly,
dope,
right,
it's pretty fragrant.
Yes. Well, we go
okay.
from, you know,
so it is ironic.
The only, you know, I guess proper nouns right in the poem, you start in the first stanza, it's Oz, which is a location. It's this kind of dreamlike location, and a non-real location. And then at the end of the poem, you're suddenly smacked with this context, right? California, you know, which, and in the context right now as we're speaking, it's very different, I think, than the composition of this poem, but California and then banker, and suddenly you're in California's economy. I mean, that's a very simplistic reading of this, but so I was, you know, I'm interested in what others might think of the sudden entry of California here.
Well, that seemed, I mean, if you're thinking of the sea in HD, which ocean is it? It's not the West Coast, it seems to me. I mean,
no,
maybe
it's always just North Atlantic.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we've traversed the continent here.
Manifest destiny.
Yeah.
Postgeist, upcast, California upon weed. What banker yields so fragrant a cant as this vagrant cant?
Let me quote from the poet, from Jen, if I may. The idea was to schmaltzify, to be indelicate, she says, HD and imagism, and more generally, it's piety that veers into preciousness. To open the poem to different scenarios tainted by class, gender, the nation state. Well, I keep somewhat simplistically thinking, what happens to imagism when politics get and economics and social ideas get to enter it? You know, Jen tells us that she wrote this poem to sort of extract some of the political, gendered, nation-state implications of imagism. And what happens when imagism goes to economics? Well, I
you
mean,
get the cantos.
You get the cantos. And the question in HD is, what meta, what nature yields something as good as what I'm interested in? And Jen turns that into, what banker, what economic theory is going to give you so fragrant a cant, either what HD did pre-Pound or separate parallel to Pound, as this vagrant cant. And that vagrant cant partly means the wandering of Scapitone across the country, the wandering of Scapitone through the words and through the exploration of other implications. There's a real doubleness to the to what happens to imagism. And I think Jen is saying to us that we need to face them. We need to face what those implications are. And the question becomes rhetorical to me. I mean, what banker, just as it does in the original, what banker uses? None. They don't.
Yeah.
They don't do that.
Yeah. It's like when you find a question in Yeats, and every time you do, an old mentor of mine once said, you can always answer, search me.
Who was that mentor, say?
Sir Christopher Ricks.
There you go. I knew there was Dylan would
of
come
course.
In somehow.
There you,
you know,
go.
Right? Well, we could talk about this forever, but I want to invite each of you to say one last thing that you meant to say that we didn't get to because my questions were so wandering, vagrant. David, you want to start? What's your last thought here?
I guess my last thought was a formal one. Most of my reading, you know, and that might be suspect on my part, was that I approached this poem formally. And again, I wonder if in the public, when the poem is published, you know, how would you read it if you encountered it completely divorced from the HD poem? Would you encounter it as formally as I did? Because, you know, my printout of these two poems has it on the same page. And so, in a sense, it would be interesting to try it again with another poem and see if, you know, if the critiques of, say, Victorianism or the critiques of imagism as an aesthetic come out in the same way. So, you know, my formal approach was really to take words and Jen's, you know, choice of substitutions and explore why those choices were made.
Thank you. Judith?
Maybe a couple of things. One, just to tack on to what you were saying earlier, the idea that that HD's poem is taking itself as a kind of gold standard, right? And mm-hmm. that in addition, I mean, as opposed to our now electronic economy, and that also that gold is actually functioning, right, as a metaphor where the flowers look like treasure. And that metaphor is sort of the gold standard of the imagistic poem. And that maybe Jen is trying to undo that as well. That could be a possibility. Another thing that I wanted to say was this: his talk has wrought suit, which is the sort of quasi-spoonerism of your stock has caught root. I think that that's an allusion to Pound.
Definitely.
And sort of creating a kind of reified shell in which HD's poems would walk around in, you know, for the rest of their existence, more or less. And so in pointing that out, I just wanted to say that this is not just a critique of HD's poem. It is rather a critique of sort of the readings surrounding imagism and like the whole history that is agglomerated onto them. So that, yeah, it's not just a direct relationship to HD, but HD's reception
nice.
Through history.
Yes, and that's the moment where her poem gets gendered, his talk specifically.
Yeah.
Don, final word?
Yeah, I just, again, appending this to what you guys have said so well just now, pulling back from it, and it's partly because of my interest emanating from Poetry Magazine and just a larger question that's out there for everybody, is that it's a curiosity that we are still wrestling or will for a long time be wrestling with the questions, what has modernism done for us and what has modernism done to us? It's, you know, in a certain way, an astonishment that people are in dialogue with poems like this at the present moment. It's almost as if we feel like we've broken away from all this and heaved pound and heaved imagism. But it's all so much still in our consciousness that it's incredible to me that the force of this work remains with us. For all the newness of our vocabulary and technology, it's almost quaint to be worried about HD's poems. But I mean, I think we're all grateful that we have that to sort of bounce up against and contend with. It's quite an accomplishment, though, that these poets did things that we still have to contend with, and contention is one of the pleasures of poetry.
Yes, and I would add that the exercise of writing through is not only a way of being critical and sometimes snarky, mm-hmm. although not in this case, but it's also the sort of homage that gets at the level of the line.
Yeah.
And that is the ultimate form of respect, in a way, is to have said, and I'm repeating what you just said, to have said that the sound of that particular line, its meter, its diction, its word choice, is in me, and I'm by rewriting it, I'm going to acknowledge that trace, that such strong trace. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Don, what are you recommending these days? You're reading a little bit of poetry in your day job.
Yeah, well, I like to read a lot of poetry, and I'm going to say something unoriginal, and that is I'm just immersed in Larry Eigner's poems. You know, Larry Eigner wrote more than 3,000 poems, and a couple dozen of them appeared in the pages of Poetry Magazine. And I'm just thrilled that Stanford University Press and Eigner's terrific editors have put together one of the most marvelous productions of our time, which is the republication
four
of
volumes,
four beautiful,
and reproduced in typewriter
courier font,
which is the way Eigner typed.
And I think it's just an incredible, you know, people talk about the death of print, and here's a great working of our print culture for us.
And I think Henry Rago, one of your predecessors, published him in the early 60s,
I think.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. David, gather some paradise.
To me, paradise is Milwaukee. Getting a carload of
Chicago
poets into a posse and driving up to Milwaukee, maybe stopping at Grappi's for a panino, and heading over to Woodland Pattern Book Center, which has been, to me, you know, sort of the mecca of poetry in the Midwest. And Carl Gartung and Anne Kingsbury, really saints. I mean, they really are the people who embody the meaning of poetry. And so anyone who doesn't know Woodland Pattern Book Center should really, make a pilgrimage.
And I believe that they have in the basement of that bookstore recordings.
They do.
I think we at Penn Sound are in touch with them about making
terrific.
Those available. Woodland, wherever you are, please send us your tapes. Thank you. Thanks a lot, all of you. Well, that's all the California weed we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Judith Goldman, David Pavlich, and Don Scher, and once again to David for hosting us and providing some of the equipment, and thanks, as always, to Poem Talk's editor, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Mark Novak, Danny Snelson, and Emily Abendroth join me to talk about Jenna Osman's poem, Dropping Leaflets. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.